towards the earlier, the end of the last presentation, I mentioned quite quickly Jesus' first time when he foretells, as the words are, his coming suffering. A couple of things need to be said about it. One is, I think I've mentioned this already, in the culture, you can do something once, well, yes, and you can repeat it twice. But in their culture, third time means persistent. It doesn't mean just one more than two and one fewer than four. It just meant Jesus kept, and you find that in the agony, third time he prayed. You find it in Peter, in the garden, in the courtyard. He denied Jesus three times, meaning constantly. He persisted in doing it. So Jesus, we're going to see, says three times, what I'm doing is going to bring suffering. So if you follow me, know that it's going to be difficult. And he says in that, and this is the bit I did too quickly with you all, because of time, obviously. On the third day, he said, he will be raised. Now, that doesn't mean Jesus is there having in his head, being told by God somehow, that he'll be crucified on a Friday and die on and resurrected on a Sunday. That's the third day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That fits nicely. But the literature doesn't allow us to think that's what Jesus has in mind. If he says, look, it's going to be the end of my life. He can see it, the vultures gathering, of course. We've seen plenty of that already. He says, but on the third day, and I said to you quickly, the third day means the day that God is revealed. And I want to read to you a little bit from Exodus chapter 19, the classical scene where this expression, on the third day, appears, I think, five times. And it's clearly what I'm expressing to you. They've come across the desert and they've arrived at the mountain. And Moses has gone up on the mountain and God has spoken to him and etc. And it says, when Moses had told the words of the people to the Lord said to Moses, go to the people, consecrate them today and tomorrow, etc., and prepare for the third day. Because on the third day, the Lord will come down on the mount in the sight of all the people. And he tells him to set limits to the thing, don't let anyone touch the mountain, etc., and keep away from it. It's all dramatic material, of course. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people, consecrated the people, etc., and said to the people, prepare for the third day. Don't go near the mountain. And he goes on, and on the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning, as well as a thick cloud on the mountain, and in the blast of the trumpet, so loud that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And so it goes on. Third day in Exodus chapter 19 is the day when God reveals who God is to the people. And so that becomes an expression on the third day, referring back to that. And basically it means it's not 2 days. There's a lovely text in Luke's gospel too when they come to Jesus And they tell him to get out because Herod is going to harm you. And Jesus says, I'm going to continue my mission today and tomorrow and the next day. Well, that's the third. But then he says, on the third day I will achieve my end. It doesn't mean, he's already talked about the third day, the next day after the second, temporally speaking, but on the third day, on God's day, when God reveals who God is, when my Father shows that his love for me is real and all of that, that's the day I will be taken into the embrace of God. So let's now come to chapter 17, verse 1. And it's linked to what I've just said. 6 days later, that's after Peter has said, you are the Messiah and so on. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun. His clothes became dazzling white. And suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah. You're looking at a very famous and a stunningly beautiful painting in the original. And here I can only do this with it. There you've got Jesus and you've got Moses with him and Elijah. Moses represents the Torah, of course. Elijah represents the prophets. So this is the whole of the Old Testament there with Jesus. But watch what happens. And by the way, the description of Jesus is taken pretty well from Exodus chapter 34, where it says, the Israelites saw Moses and the skin of his face was shining. They were afraid to come near him. Jesus is depicted in this dramatic presentation. Jesus often would have gone up onto a mountain to pray. And the disciples, we know that from elsewhere in the text, and the disciples were wondering, had they gone up on Mount Tabor and had they had a video, what do you think they would have seen? Well, I don't particularly know. They may have just seen Jesus in prayer. Really simple, but something quite stunning about it. How do they communicate that to us? That's what the Gospels are. How do you tell people who weren't there what happened? And so they've got him like Moses with God in this scene and his face shining, etc. Continue. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll make 3 dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them. I hope your imagination is going back to the baptism, because that's where it should be going. And from the cloud came, this is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. The same words used at the baptism, the first scene we saw of Jesus. Here it is again. But added to it are the next words. Listen to him. That's what the early church, Peter, Mark, now Matthew, is trying to communicate to us all. He's the one you listen to. When the disciples heard this, they fell on the ground and were overcome with fear. But Jesus came and touched them and said, get up, don't be afraid. And here's the key point of the wonderfully simple but beautiful scene. When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. Had they given a sermon in here, as Paul gives often throughout his letters and in the Acts of the Apostles, etc., had they preached a sermon, they would have said something like I'm going to say now. Yes, we need Moses. law. We need the prophets, Elijah. They're all important. They've got value. But actually, all that they've said and done, all the revelations that lead up to this, it's all in Jesus. Listen to him. And if you find something in the book of, which you'll do, in the book of Leviticus that is against what Jesus is revealing, please listen to Jesus. When he says to you, it was said of old, but I say to you, it was said of old, the enemies all the way through the Bible, the enemies of God are spoken about, and they're Jewish enemies. Moabites, Edomites, etc. They're all enemies, and they presume they're enemies of God. No, says Jesus, God doesn't have enemies. So love your enemies the way God does. Look at the rain and look at the sun and look at nature and stop all this stupidity. Well, that's what they did, a homily. But what a beautiful scene to say it so clearly. You're just watching it and you get it. Imagination gets it. Moses, Elijah, Jesus in discussion, radiant in Jesus' case with love of God and prayer. And at the end, Jesus touches his disciples, you, me, and says, they look up and they, oh, Elijah isn't there anymore. Moses isn't there anymore. It's only Jesus. And that's all we need. By all means, read the Old Testament. It's beautiful, as you do. A lot of it's beautiful. But never read it except through Jesus' eyes and reflect it in his life and state it in the way he lived and the way he revealed God in prayer. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Jesus is constantly fighting the danger of populism. God, we see that in the world today. It's just an extraordinary amount of stuff, and it's so bad. Anyhow, because people as a crowd can be almost made to do anything with fake news and all the stuff you know about. So Jesus ordered them, don't tell anyone. He doesn't want to be popular. He wants to meet people in love and invite them to understand God. The disciples asked him, why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? And they've been taught as a kid, Malachi chapter 3, you find it there. Jesus replied, Elijah is indeed coming. So he's playing with the text. Elijah is indeed coming and will restore all things. But I tell you, Elijah has already come. Huh? They didn't recognize him. But they did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man is about to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood, they got to the deeper meaning, that he was speaking about John the Baptist. Another marvellous scene. And there's a marvellous painting again. That's the one I showed you, the top part of it before, the Transfiguration, or I think the author called it Faith. If you look at the lower part now, while that's all happening on the mountain in this dramatic presentation of deep truths, downstairs, if you count them, there's the other nine apostles. There's also on the right-hand side a dad with a boy. And if you look at it, the boy is the only one looking up. The author has captured this beautifully. He's the only one looking up. He's the connection between the lower part and the upper part. But he's actually the one who's said to be mad. But he's the only one who sees. Anyhow, you've got the 12 there. Look at them. They're busy. Some of them are reading. Some of them are pointing. Some of them are pointing up but not looking up. They're busy, 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 busy something. And in the middle, there's a woman. She's not in the scene of the gospel. But she's put there because she's called Faith. If you actually look at the painting sometime really closely, she's very strong. And she's looking at the nine, the church officials, and pointing back to the boy, and she's saying, why don't you do something about it? She's strong. I think you could say she's angry. And they're all confused. Let's look at the scene that the author there is painting. The author, of course, I beg your pardon, is Raphael. When they came to the crowd, a man came to him. This is much better in Mark, as a lot of these scenes are, because Mark doesn't have so many sayings of Jesus. He's got more room to tell the story. Matthew concentrates it a lot, and therefore it's not quite as good dramatically, but this is Matthew. When they came to the crowd, a man came to him, knelt before him and said, Lord, have mercy on my son. He's an epileptic and he suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire, into the water. I brought him to your disciples, that's the scene you see there, but they couldn't cure him. And Jesus answered, you faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you? A favourite words of Matthew's gospel. Bring him here to me. Jesus rebuked the demon, the daimon, explained that earlier, and it came out of him, and the boy was cured instantly. The disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why couldn't we cast out the evil spirit, the daimon? Why couldn't we heal the man? And Jesus said to them, because of your little faith. They weren't open enough to love the way Jesus was. And we have to keep opening ourselves to love. Truly, I tell you, if you have faith, it's not the amount of faith you've got, it's the faith has to be real. If you have faith and it's only the size of a mustard seed, you'll say to the mountain, move from here and it'll move. Nothing will be impossible. Of course, Jesus isn't interested in changing the landscape. But that's an image for something that might look impossible to us. Well, a lot of things look impossible, but they're not if you have faith. So believe and make it real faith. As they were gathering in Galilee, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands, and they'll kill him. Here it is again, and on the third day he will be raised. He's totally confident in the love of his Father, and he knows the Father, and he knows that the Father loves him and will embrace him beyond the limitations of this world we're in. And it's the same for us. Jesus believes in the resurrection, because he believes in God's love. They were greatly distressed, of course. When they reached Capernaum, the collectors of the temple, this is a bit of a humorous scene, really. It's only in Matthew, but I'll just read it. When they reached Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the temple tax? And I've got what it was. It was a double drachma, or in fact half a shekel. Shekel's a measure of weight. And Peter said, yes, he does. Well, he's hoping Jesus does. He doesn't want Jesus to get into trouble. He says, yes, he does. And when he came home, Jesus spoke of it first, asking, what do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tribute? Do they take it from their sons? Clearly no. Or from other people? And when Peter said from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. You're not bound by the temple tax. However, says Jesus, so that we don't give offence to them and cause trouble unnecessarily. And this is his advice to Peter. Go to the sea, throw a line in, take the first fish that comes up, open its mouth, and you'll find a coin in there that'll cover us both. Take that, give it to them for you and me. Now, all the miracle scenes in the gospel, there's a way of writing them. So Jesus says something is going to happen and then the crowd see it and then they rejoice. There's nothing about this one being successful. It doesn't say, and Peter went down to the coast and caught a fish and etc., etc. It doesn't say that at all. I think we're meant to be all laughing at this. Jesus had a lovely sense of humour. He had to have, because he's such an intelligent, beautiful man. So I imagine, dear Simon, Jesus telling him what to do. You've just heard it. Simon goes out and starts to do it. And the rest of them, the 11, look at Jesus, and Jesus looks at them and they were all laughing. And then after a few yards, Peter, I'm adding this, it's not in the gospel, but Peter says, I think I've been had. And he comes back to Jesus and they say, it's okay, Peter, we're laughing with you, not against you, etc. But that, you know, that's the scene. Now we come to the fourth list of the sayings. The first was the Sermon on the Mount, discipleship. The second was mission. Not as much in that, but there were some. The third were the parables about God's reign and what it looks like, and in images, of course, in story. And now the fourth one is about community. So there's something we can learn in here. Again, it's fairly brief, but it's about important things for community. And Matthew records things that he heard Jesus say here and somewhere else and somewhere else, and as it came up, but he puts them together, right? The church is in a special way God's household. Jesus teaches his disciples how to live as members of God's household. For the church is a community of Jesus' brothers and sisters. Everything in Jesus' covenant community is based on the intimacy which God offers Jesus' disciples in their relationship to him. An intimacy shared with Jesus, who is, the words, among them. And note the constant mention of the word Father here in these words about the community. Chapter 18 of Matthew. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Jesus calls a little kid over and he puts the little child with among them and he says, look, I tell you truly, unless you change and become like a child, you'll never enter the kingdom. Whoever becomes humble like this child, that person is the greatest in the kingdom of God. And he adds, whoever welcomes me, welcomes one such child in my name, welcomes me. And he goes on to say, the child, not childish, we're not supposed to be childish, but with that kind of innocence, trust. Well, all you know of a child at a child's best. That's an image Jesus puts forward for a disciple. And it goes on here. How relevant is this? If any of you put a stumbling block, and here's the Greek word, a scandal. That's what scandal means. They had their races, as you know, and some of them we did as kids too. You'd have an obstacle race. Yeah, there'd be things stopping you on the way, getting in the road. Well, if anyone does something, puts an obstacle, a scandal, before one of these little ones who believe in me, now he doesn't just mean children here, he means anyone who becomes a real disciple, because it makes you very vulnerable. You haven't got at your disposal power, and you haven't got whatever else. You're just a simple, gentle, hope you know people like this, hope you like this, person who's little, like a child, and therefore trusting and vulnerable. Well, if anyone puts a stumbling block before such a person, it'd be better for you to be a great millstone were fastened round your neck and you're drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of stumbling blocks. Occasions of stumbling are bound to come, but woe to the one by whom the scandal, the stumbling block comes. And then, very exaggerated words, but they make the point. If your hand is your problem, or your foot, well then cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or lame than to have two hands or 2 feet and be thrown into the eternal fire. In other words, have your life destroyed. If your eye causes you to stumble, so you might be envious because you see something and you really want it and all the rest of it. If your eye causes you to stumble, well, tear it out and throw it away. It's better to enter into life with one eye than to have two and be thrown into Gehenna. And I've done that already with you. I'll leave it as done. The Gehenna of fire, which is a symbol. This valley to the south of Jerusalem is a symbol of self-destruction and community destruction. Paul in Romans 14 picks up the same image. Let us resolve instead never to put a stumbling block or hindrance, a scandal, in the way of another person. Take care, says Jesus, that you don't despise one of the little ones, one of the simple, gentle, lovely, humble, these beautiful people that your parish and mine are full of. This is the norm, really. So don't despise anyone like that. For I tell you, in heaven, their angels continually see the face of my Father in heaven. Little children, yes, but a little child in the sense of an adult who is simple and humble and the rest. They're angels. Angels is a new thought that's come in here. In the Old Testament scriptures, there aren't any angels. There's a presence called the angel of the Lord, but that's God. And there is a story in Tobit about Raphael, like in the later part of the writings, not the Torah. There's this, but the idea of angels and devils are not part of the Hebrew culture. They've come in from Iran, in fact, with trade and various things. So by the time the New Testament's written, these are angels and devils are kind of all over the place. It's part of their culture. The Romans had a similar thing. There was the Roman, every gens, that is every family that traced itself back, and they thought it was important, every gens had a genius, and that genius was a kind of a, I don't know, heavenly, powerful representative for that family, patriarchal family. The Greeks had daimon. I've talked about that already, and they weren't all bad daimons. Some of them are wonderful, but it's a thing, it's a spirit. Well, here we have Jesus talking about angels. Matthew 18:12. What do you think, says Jesus, to them and now to us? If a shepherd has 100 sheep and one of them's gone astray, doesn't he leave the 99 in the mountains? Of course, under the care of one of the local boys or girls who look after them. He's not abandoning them, but he leaves them. And he goes in search of the one that went astray. And they'd all say, yeah, we do that. If he finds it, and again they do this too, I tell you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 who never went astray. He's taking them a bit for granted, but he's so delighted that he found this 100th sheep and he brings it home and they're all thinking, oh, great. And that little section concludes in this beautiful verse, 18:14. It's not the will of your Father in heaven that one of these little ones should be lost. No one is. God doesn't want anyone to be lost. And if we go back to the, I won't do it for long, of course, the story of hell we were talking about yesterday. God doesn't want anyone to be lost. Please God, no one is, ultimately. Please God, when we come to die, not, God is beautiful, we're not talking about God here, but hopefully God is so beautiful that in the dying process we might see, realise and repent. It's okay to hope for that. The church teaches us that there is a place called heaven, and the church also teaches us that there are saints. That's the canonization process, is to assure us that there are. The church teaches us that there is a hell. The church doesn't teach us that anyone's in, if I could use that word, hell. It's a kind of a warning to us to take life seriously. But we don't have to. Please God, no one ever is that stubborn. Please God, I'm not like that, and you're not like that. So that we'll see the need for love and welcome it. We don't know, we can hope for that. Now in this, still talking about the church and the community and who's the greatest and all that, if another member of the church sins against you, here's advice that they must have picked up in the early church and said Jesus must have given this advice at one stage in some kind of terms anyhow. If another person of the church sins against you and point out your fault, go and point out the fault when the two of you are alone. And if that other person listens to you, well, it's all fixed. You're okay. You've talked and said, look, why did you say that? And they say, oh, God, I didn't really mean it that way. And you've done all this so you know what it means. But it doesn't always work. If you're not listened to by the person who's hurt you or harmed you, if you're not listened to, well, then take one or two others along with you so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. Maybe they'll take notice when two or three of you come and say, hey, Michael or whatever, what you did then was very harmful and you don't seem to realise it, and explain it to me and I might listen. But maybe I won't. If the member refuses to listen even to the community, then tell it to the whole church. And if the offender refuses to listen even to the church, the community, let such a one be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Jesus is absolutely not putting down Gentiles or tax collectors. It's just that the church has no authority over Gentiles, and the synagogue doesn't have any authority over the, so it's no longer your business. You've done your best, you've taken it finally to the church, the person won't listen, and so you have this thing that happened. Paul's got it in his letters, and it's happened all the time through the church, often badly, but no doubt often well too. We call it excommunication. It isn't saying, let's say I'm the offender. It's not saying, Michael, you're out, and making an act of pushing me out. It's saying, Michael, do you realise you're out? You've made yourself out by your behaviour. And the excommunication, the statement that I'm not belonging, that has to be shown, is there only for the purpose of my waking up, realising I need the community, I need the Eucharist, and then, please God, I'll come back and admit my fault. Truly, I tell you, here it is, the statement that we read earlier in relation to Peter, just the last meditation. Now it's to the whole church, it's to all of us. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. The community has a special relationship with God in its judgments, etc. Again, I tell you truly, if two of you agree on anything, about anything you ask, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, I am there among them. A beautiful statement. You can find it also, by the way, or very similar, so it must have been part of the culture. There's a rabbi, Hanina ben Teradion. He died in 135 AD, so at the second revolt and the final destruction of Jerusalem. And this is one of his sayings, and we can find it in the Mishnah. When two are seated and discuss the Torah, the Shekhinah resides among them. The presence, we might say. So there's just two of us. It's a beaut to pray on your own, but you're praying with someone else, just the two. Well, the presence, says this rabbi, is there with you. Lovely. He's Jesus. Where two or three are gathered in my name, I'm there among them. Peter came and said to Jesus, Lord, if another member of the church sins against me, and that's the topic at the moment, how often should I forgive? And he's wonderful. He says, have I got to do it seven times? And Jesus says to him, not seven, 70 times seven. And of course, that's not a limit. Just saying, no, this has to be an unlimited thing. Keep forgiving. Keep giving yourself. It may not achieve reconciliation, but stay who you are. For this reason, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished, this is a very powerful story, a king who wished to settle accounts with his slaves. You know this story, but there may be an element in it that you haven't realised that I might be able to help point out to you. When he began the reckoning, there was one there who owed him 10,000 talents. 60 million denarii is what that is, and a denarius is a day's wage. So it's trillions, I don't know how you translate it today, but it's a unthinkable amount of money. He was brought to him and he couldn't pay, and the Lord ordered him to be sold together with his wife and children and all his possessions, and payment to be made. Wouldn't quite pay for it, but he'd get all he can out of him. So the slave fell on his knees before him and said, look, please be patient with me and I'll pay you everything. And out of pity for him, the Lord of that slave released him and forgave him the debt. Heavens, how marvelous is that? And here's the point of the story. But the same slave, says Jesus, he went out and came upon one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. And I want to stress with you, that's not a small amount. That's 100 days' wages. Well, that's a third of your year's income. So we're talking about, the other's an impossible amount. This is a real amount, and it's quite significant. He owed him 100 denarii, and so he seized this other slave by the throat and said, pay what you owe. Then the fellow slave fell down and pleaded with him, have patience with me, I will pay you. But he refused and went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. When his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, as you or I would be. And they went and reported to their Lord what had taken place. And the Lord summoned him and said to him, you wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Shouldn't you have mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you? And in anger, this is the story, it's not talking about God here, it's just in anger, the Lord handed him over to the torturers until he'd pay the entire debt. So my Heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you don't forgive your brother or sister from your heart. You'll end up being outside too, says Jesus. And how important that is when you think of all that God has forgiven me. What am I doing not forgiving you? There's no comparison. So the story is powerful and very relevant to our lives. The importance of forgiveness. When Jesus had finished these sayings, so we've entered the fourth list of sayings. He left for Galilee, went to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, and large crowds followed him and he cured them there. So we've just completed the fourth teaching section in which Matthew focused on how the community of Jesus' disciples is to work for and maintain unity. And a lot of it has to do with honesty, naming things the way they are, but full of mercy and full of compassion. Now, as Jesus journeys to Jerusalem, the contrast between those who are for Jesus and those who are against him becomes more and more stark. The reader is invited to choose in favour of God's Messiah. Some Pharisees came to Jesus, and to test him, they don't come to find out, they don't come to be enlightened, they come to show him how wrong he is and have the crowd see how stupid Jesus is. That's their aim, and get him into trouble with the law if they can. The Pharisees came in to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? Cooking has gone off. Could be anything. Only men could divorce in this world. And Rabbi Hillel, who died when Jesus was a boy, that was his opinion. His opinion that is a man can divorce his wife for anything at all. There was another opinion around, which we'll come to in a moment. Shammai, who lived through Jesus' life, a younger man, but also a wiser one, I would think, who said, no, there has to be strong restrictions on this. A man can't just do it as on a whim. Anyhow, back to the text. Jesus answered, look, haven't you read that the one who made them in the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife and the two will become one flesh. Please don't think, though it's quoted as though it did, this has nothing to do with homosexuality or heterosexuality. We're talking about a heterosexual marriage. The two are no longer two, says Jesus, they're one. So what God has joined together, let no one separate. And in there, you've got to read St. Paul, I mentioned it quickly the other day, you've got to read the churches. It's been a very complex journey right through the church's life. How do we know what God has put together? Yeah, we know signatures have been put there. We know a ceremony took place, etc., etc. But don't let's be too quick to think we know what God put together. Anyhow, I'll leave that back to the text. They said to him, wait a minute. Why did Moses command us to give a certificate of dismissal and to divorce her? And that's in Deuteronomy chapter 24. It's part of Moses, it's part of the Torah. And a very important part, because this puts limits on male power. Thank God, a little bit of a limit. In other words, if I divorce my wife, whether it's for a serious reason or for anything at all, I have to give her a document to say, I've divorced you. I can never take her back. She can show that to anyone else that she's free to marry and find love at last, because obviously I haven't loved her very well. So it was a good effort to bring a bit of humanity into complex thing of marriage. He said, Jesus says, look, it's because you were so hard-hearted that Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but that's not the way it was from the beginning. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, and this comes into Shammai now, the other who died in 30 AD, about the same time as Jesus. Jesus may have died in 30 or 33. There's a bit of debate on that, but it's either of those dates. So all through Jesus' life, Shammai was there. And he had the opinion, yes, he never thought a man couldn't divorce his wife. No one thought that, because they're all men writing the bloody stuff, excuse the expression. So, but they could only do it except for if it's a case of unchastity. What does that mean? Very complicated. I won't go into it now, but it could be marriages. It's not a real marriage at all. It's a marriage that isn't according to the laws of Leviticus. So, and you read through those if you want to. You can find them all there. And this is a kind of living together situation, but not really a marriage. Well, in that case, yes, you can divorce. Whoever divorces his wife, but not in that hurtful, etc., they commit adultery. And the disciples, men, this is their response. Pretty realistic, I think. They said, well, look, if it's as bad as that, well, it's better not to marry if you can't. Say the boys can't have power to. It's pretty dreadful reading this stuff, isn't it? Jesus said to them, this is all we've got to go on now. Not everyone can accept this teaching. Only those to whom it is given. There are eunuchs who've been so from birth. Men who can't have children, something wrong physically. There are eunuchs who've been made eunuchs by others. That went on in some of them, not in the Jewish culture, but in some of the cultures. They were made eunuchs so that they'd be safe. They wouldn't be having an affair with the Pharaoh's wife or with the king's consort or something. So they were made eunuchs. And here's this mysterious thing. There are eunuchs who've made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the reign of God, for love. Let anyone make room for this who can. The Greek choreo, we've got it in choreography. So it's you're meant to see it. If your heart's big enough, to leave marriage, go, and live a celibate life, really, the way Jesus. And this is one of the bases of the beginnings for church. There's always been people who've chosen celibacy, some for not very good reasons and all the rest of it. But there is this constant in the church desire among Christians, some Christians, to live and love the way Jesus did, without a sexual companion, wife, husband, etc. And in the early church, by the way, a lot of celibacy, brackets, was post-marriage celibacy. It's hard to imagine Paul wasn't a married man. We don't hear about it back in his past life, because everyone married, like it was part of their culture. Celibacy wasn't part of the Judean Jewish culture. But he, by the time we meet him in his letters, he's chosen. He could have married again, because a lot of women died in childbirth in those days. It was very, well, quite common for marriage to cease because of the death of the wife. And a lot of those men went into ministry, etc. Sorry, I said all that pretty poorly, but it needs more time and more delicacy, but anyhow, I've done my best at it just for the moment. There's that Jesus saying what God has put together. So look for what God has put together in your life, my life, their life, and don't interfere with that. Chapter 19:13, little children were being brought to Jesus that he might lay his hands on them and pray. The disciples spoke sternly against those who brought the children, mostly mums, I imagine. And Jesus said, look, let the little children come to me. Don't stop them. It's to such as these that the kingdom of heaven belongs. And we've heard that already. So Jesus embraced them and then went on his way. Someone then came to Jesus and said, Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? A very beautiful question. We can all ask it. Eternal life doesn't mean something that starts when you die. It means life that's not ups and downs depending on the fluctuations of the emails and all the rest of it. This is life that's divine, God-given. And he can see Jesus has it, and the disciples seem to have it, and he knows he hasn't got it. He wants to know, what have I got to do to have that life? And Jesus said, look, what are you doing calling me good? There's only one who's good. Jesus, as he would all the time have done, points away from himself to his Father, to God. If you wish to enter into eternal life, well then, keep the commandments. You've read about that, says Jesus. And he said to them, which ones? And Jesus says, goes through the Ten Commandments, all the ones that apply to behaviour. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honour your father and your mother. Also, says Jesus, adding to the Ten Commandments, also, you should love your neighbour as you love yourself. And the young man said to Jesus, how beautiful is this? I've kept all these. He must have been an absolutely wonderful young man. He's kept all the commandments. He has loved others as he loves himself even. So that's, but he said, what do I still lack? I'm missing something. What is it? And he can see it in the apostles and in Jesus and in the women around and the disciples and all that. And Jesus said to him, look, if you really want to be perfect, if you want to be perfect, this is said to the young man, it's not said to any of us. It may apply or it may not. But in this man's case, this was the problem that was holding him back. If you wish to be perfect, go and sell your possessions. Your problem is you're too cluttered, he's saying, with stuff. And other people need it, and you don't need it. Get rid of it. Clear your heart and your home and all the rest of it. If you wish to be perfect, go and sell your possessions. Give the money you make to the poor, and you'll have a treasure in heaven. And then, come, join us, and you'll experience the eternal life you're longing for. What a beautiful gift. But when the young man heard this, he went away grieving. He had many possessions. That can be our problem too. Physical possessions are the least of the problems, but that could be a problem. But anything we possess, anything that possesses us, could be our reputation, it could be our intelligence, it could be our God knows what. Whatever is there that I won't let go is the problem here. I might have to let it go. It may be good to keep it and give it to it, etc. There's no, but this, in this young man's case, that's what he needs to let go. So what do I need to let go to enjoy this? What do you need to let go? What do you need to walk away from and towards? Oh, says Jesus with a big sigh, truly I tell you, it'll be hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven, rich in any way. I tell you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who's rich to enter the kingdom of God. A trivial little point to make, but years ago people used to say, well, the eye of a needle was that narrow door out in the wall of the temple, etc. And that did exist in medieval times, not now. And that they said that's the eye of the needle, and a camel has to, it's difficult for a camel to get through it. Well, that's wrong, so can I, if you've ever thought that or told it, put it away. I wonder whether camel is the right translation. A camel going through a needle, Jesus' images are usually very natural and very real, if exaggerated, of course. And maybe this is one of them. But I want to tell you there's two Greek words. Camelos is the Greek word for a camel. There's another Greek word, kamelos, with an E instead of an E, instead of a long A, E to long E, it's got an E, short I. And that means a rope. The rope on a rowing boat, they all were familiar with. And they couldn't push it, it'd be very difficult. You've known that when you try and thread a needle. If your stuff's too thick, it won't go through. That, to me, makes sense. And I want to add the fact that the long E, eta, it's called, the long E in Greek, as you see it in kamer, technically it should be kamelos. But it was pronounced at this time kamelos, exactly the same sound as the other word. In fact, we see that in kyrie eleison, ki-i-i. It's in the Bible, in the New Testament too. But it's actually a long E. Kyrie, it should be. But anyhow, so maybe what Jesus said, only suggested, and then I'll let it go, I'm wasting time on you. Maybe what Jesus said, look, it's easier, and you blokes know this, you fishermen know this, to push a thick rope through an ordinary needle than for someone who's rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. We'll have no music again, and I'll just do this quickly. There's a landowner who went out, beautiful story, And he agrees, you know it. At the more beginning of the day, they're going to have a denarius. Fine, they said, thanks. They went into work. Then he comes out later, comes out at 5 to 6 in the evening or just before sunset and says, what are you doing here? And they says, no one's employed us. I imagine Jesus probably had that experience quite often. And his dad, Joseph, probably too. It was quite common for landowners, of course they want help, but for people to be left outside. Then what this landowner does, the last one who was only there just before midnight, gets a denarius, and all the rest are all excited. They want a denarius too, but they complain.